morning, Your Honors. Robert Kennedy on behalf of the Commission. This case concerns 25 emails redacted on the grounds of attorney-client privilege by J.P. Morgan and produced to the Commission during the course of its investigation of allegations of market manipulation. The Commission challenged those privilege assertions in a subpoena enforcement action in district court, and after the matter was assigned to a magistrate judge, the magistrate denied the Commission's petition, finding that all of the redactions were, quote, of communications between respondent, there, J.P. Morgan, and its counsel acting as counsel with respect to legal advice. And we would submit that that conclusion is due no deference from this court for two reasons. The first, the core holding in the magistrate judge's opinion that all of the redactions are of communications between J.P. Morgan and its counsel is contradicted by the record. We know that 12 of the 25...
That doesn't go to deference.
Excuse me?
That doesn't go to deference.
Well, I think one of the matters that the court looks at in determining whether the court abuses discretion or is owed deference is whether the lower court's opinion is supported by the record. And here, as I said, one of the core conclusions is contradicted by the record. For the second reason we believe no deference is due is because the court didn't make any individualized findings with respect to these documents or any categories of documents, nor did the magistrate judge explain the legal reasoning supporting her conclusion that these communications were in fact privileged. The magistrate judge's opinion cites, I believe, three cases, has a page or two of discussion of general privilege principles, but really makes no effort to explain how those general principles apply to this case. And this case doesn't involve the prototypical privilege claim with respect to communications between an attorney and a client. Here we have, excuse me, claims relating to implied requests for legal advice, the privilege asserted with respect to communications between non-attorneys, the privilege asserted with respect to business communications that are intertwined with legal issues. So we think the facts of this case are consistent with the court's 1997 sealed case opinion, where similar factors were present, and the court determined that there was no deference due to the magistrate judge's opinion. There's really three general groupings of emails at issue in this appeal, and the first are two emails for which J.P. Morgan didn't provide any support in either its pleadings before the magistrate judge or in the Krupka declaration for their privilege claims. And this is items 1 and 17 in Addendum B to the Commission's brief, Exhibit A, and one of the emails in Exhibit H in J.P. Morgan's submission. And as the proponent of the privilege, it was J.P. Morgan's burden to come forward with sufficient facts establishing the privilege with reasonable certainty.
Said number 1 and number 17?
Correct. The magistrate judge ordered J.P. Morgan in the order to the district court judge ordered J.P. Morgan in the order to show cause to submit a responsive brief addressing all the matters raised in the Commission's petition, addressing why it shouldn't be ordered to produce the 25 emails. And these two emails are not discussed anywhere in there. And in the absence of any public explanation of public support and explanation of its privilege claim, we believe the emails should be produced. Now, J.P. Morgan contends that their failure to address these emails should be excused for two reasons. First, they claim that the Commission failed to alert the magistrate judge to the fact that that J.P. Morgan hadn't supported its privilege claims, the argument that we waived any claim of waiver. And that's flatly belied by the record. This issue arose when J.P. Morgan filed its opposition papers. The very next pleading from the Commission, its reply brief, pointed out its failure to support these privilege claims in the body of the brief. Along with that reply brief, the Commission also submitted an exhibit, numbered Exhibit 7, which I think is at 323 of the JA. It's an email-by-email catalog of what was the perceived deficiencies in J.P. Morgan's privilege claim. Both with respect to Exhibit A and Exhibit H, the Commission pointed out to the magistrate judge that there had been no support offered for the privilege claims as to these communications, sometimes even in bold print. The second argument J.P. Morgan makes in this regard is that, well, we gave the magistrate judge the documents, so what else do we have to do? And we submit that this court has made clear in a variety of privilege contexts that simply submitting a batch of documents to the court for in-camera review is not enough.
Just for a moment that the document A says on its face, "Dear counsel, we need legal advice on question X." You're saying that's not privileged And counsel writes back and says, or ticks back and says, my answer is, why? You're saying that's not privileged unless they do something else besides let the magistrate judge see it in camera?
Well, yeah, I think there has to be some public explanation of
why.
Well, for,
I mean, it's on its face, it's the giving of legal advice by counsel.
Well, I think
counsel to identifiable member of the Upjohn protected, then why?
I think the adversarial process demands it. I think the opponent of the
that's another way of stating the same proposition, but it doesn't give me the reason why.
Well, because there must be some opportunity for the proponent of the privilege to explain perhaps why that communication wouldn't be privileged. Maybe there's no argument to be made.
If it is privileged on its face and it's being seen in camera, I'm not sure that I understand. I don't understand your point that there's something else they have to do to make it privileged.
Well, there must be some explanation in their pleading explaining to the extent possible without waiving the privilege why they believe that communication is privileged. So if
you're not giving me an answer to the question, you're telling me they must do it in these terms or they must do it in those terms, but I'm not getting the reason why they must.
To give the opponent an opportunity to contest.
What if it's so clear on its face that there's nothing you can say? I thought your argument here has to do with how much deference is owed to the district court's opinion. If it's a circumstance where it's absolutely clear on its face to us, reviewing it completely de novo, that it's privileged, then it doesn't really matter what the standard of review is. If it's a situation, maybe like one you're contemplating, where it's not so clear and they haven't given any explanation, maybe there's no way to know for sure that this is from a lawyer or not, then their failure to give support fits your argument. But if it's absolutely clear on its face that it's a communication from a lawyer to the client or from the client to the lawyer communicating clearly confidential information and legal advice, I don't understand your argument.
Well, I think there's two support arguments that we've made in our brief. One relates to those circumstances where, and this generally arises in circumstances where it's communications between business people that are copied to counsel. And one of our arguments there is that the privilege turns on the intent of the author.
But that's a different question. That's not the
correct.
Question. That's not the question we're asking you. That's a question where I think I understand what you're saying. The question Judge Santel asked is quite different. It's one where it's absolutely clear to us on its face that this is privileged material. You're saying they have to turn it over anyway because they haven't done anything more than give the document to the district court.
I believe this court's decisions in the FOIA context, state secrets, law enforcement privileges, and the cases are cited in our brief, requires there to be some public explanation as to why the material.
It's part of a stronger argument on your
it's,
side.
It's part of your obligation, and I think based on the descriptions that what we do know about these documents is that it's not the type of material that's clearly a request. None of these are a request directly from a lawyer client to a lawyer. But the second grouping of documents, we touched on this before, is the emails between business people that are copied to counsel, and I think this is 13 of the 25. And the issue with respect to these is really
Which exhibits again? Are you talking about now?
Well, it's it varies a little bit. They're not in consecutive order, but it is exhibits. This grouping covers items 3, 4, 9, 10, 16 through 18, 19, 20 through 23, and 24 and 25. And the issue with respect to these emails is one of intent. Was the author's primary purpose in sending the emails to this grouping of people? Was it motivated by a request for legal advice, or was it motivated by some other purpose? And one of the cases cited by the magistrate judge, ISS Marine Services, a district court case from this circuit, analyzed this court's privilege precedent and determined that the question to be asked in order to determine whether a communication was primarily a request for legal advice is whether it would have been sent but for the request for legal advice. If the email would have been sent anyway, it's difficult to conclude that it was motivated primarily by a request for legal advice. And here we get into our second issue with respect to the manner in which J.P. Morgan went about supporting its privilege claim. There is nothing from the authors of these emails indicating why counsel was copied on a particular email. Now, certainly we don't dispute the notion that on its face an email copied to counsel could be privileged. It could contain an express request for legal advice, and maybe even if there isn't something as express as "Dear counsel, what do you think about X?" maybe it's the inescapable conclusion from the language of the documents that the communication was motivated by a request for legal advice. But from what we can tell from J.P. Morgan's pleadings, it doesn't appear to be the case here. We have implicit requests for legal advice that this is a request for legal advice can be discerned from the tenor, the broader conversation that was going on at the time. And in such circumstances, we submit it's their burden as a proponent of the privilege to come forward with competent evidence establishing the elements of the privilege. That's what the district court directed them to do in the order to show cause. And one of the elements is that the primary purpose in making the communication was to seek legal advice. The third groupings of documents that we have is emails that are strictly between non-attorneys. And this covers, Your Honors, item 2, 5 through 8, 11, 12, and 12 through 15. We don't dispute the notion that in order for the privilege to be effective in the corporate context, there must be some allowance to be made for the dissemination of legal advice from the attorney to the various employees, those who have a need to know and those who need to put the advice into action. But we think, based on what we can tell about the claims made here, that they extend beyond that limitation. With respect to a number of emails, and this transcends both the non-attorney emails and it crisscrosses and the ones that are copied to counsel, J.P. Morgan says that the communications discuss legal advice, which is a somewhat vague term. Obviously, if the discussion of legal advice reveals counsel's advice, then we don't quibble with the notion that that could be privileged. But to the extent that the non-attorneys are injecting their own views on a matter that was discussed with counsel, giving their own advice, their own take on the matter, we don't think that would be privileged. And in this regard, I think the court's opinion in the Lindsay case is instructive. There, the issue was whether Mr. Lindsay's communications with the president, the communications between the president's personal attorneys and the president, could be privileged under intermediary theory. And the court said, yes.
This is not an intermediary theory.
Correct.
But this is a classic Upjohn fact situation.
Well, I think the underlying, in Lindsay, the court said, yes, when you're conveying what outside counsel says, you're furthering the purpose of the privilege, allowing the dissemination of effective legal advice, so that's privilege. But if you go beyond and give your own views, then that's not privilege. This is not a perfect analogy, but I think the motivating factor in Upjohn that there needs to be effective communication in some matters will make some allowance. When the non-attorney goes beyond that and gives their own views, they're not furthering the dissemination of counsel's legal advice. So I don't think those communications would be privileged. The second category that comes under this general heading are communications between non-employees preparing at some point to seek legal advice. Now, strictly speaking, these aren't communications with counsel. So they don't fall within the privilege. Some courts, however, have recognized that maybe these communications could be privileged under the theory that they're akin to, in the personal individual client context, notes or an agenda. There is some logic to that position. To the extent the court is inclined to extend the privilege in this regard, I think it's very important that some clear markers be in place. The danger, in my view, is that if you say preparatory communication between non-employees preparing to seek legal advice is privileged, you could have a situation where on April 1st, employee A and B begin discussing an issue, and on April 30th, they come to the realization that, you know what, this is what we should ask our lawyer about this. I think the test needs to be clear that it's, and stringent enough that it doesn't allow a party to pull back to April 1st and extend the privilege, because the purpose is to encourage client candor. That's the purpose of the privilege in communications with their attorney. So until there's a definite and firm conviction of seeking legal advice regarding a matter, the communications between the non-employee shouldn't be privileged, even if the next day they decide, you know what, let's take this to the lawyer. So there should be...
So once there is a decision to seek legal advice, or perhaps even more strongly, once a lawyer says, collect up your ideas and then get them to me, you don't dispute that those communications among the non-lawyers for the purpose of collecting materials to transmit to the lawyer?
Well, I think in the collecting materials context, where the communications emanating ultimately from the attorney, no, to the extent that the...
No, you don't dispute.
Correct. To the extent the parties, the people who are either being interviewed or asked for documents, know that the purpose of the communication is ultimately to seek legal advice. Again, this sort of flows from Upjohn, where the court recognized that the animating purpose of the privilege is to foster candid conversations between a client and an attorney. And if the client doesn't know that it's being asked for information in order to eventually seek legal advice or to assist counsel in providing legal advice, then the purpose of the privilege isn't served, and it shouldn't be extended to those communications. On the other end, when the idea is emanating with the employees, I think there should be some evidence on the record, either the face of the document or other competent evidence establishing that, yes, at this point we had a firm conviction in mind to seek legal advice on this issue, and our communication was...
That firm conviction line come from anywhere, or are you making that up?
No, I don't believe... I mean, it's not a test. There's just a few cases out there, a few district court cases that even extend the privilege to this. But I think, given what they analogize it to and the purposes of the privilege, that it's a reasonable...
Let me ask you one more thing about that second grouping, the 3, 4, 9, 10, where the attorneys are on the CC line. Are you seriously contending that it matters whether the lawyer's on CC line or on the 2 line?
No. Our point there is that it, merely because an attorney, first of all, merely because an attorney shows up on the... anywhere in the email doesn't mean that it's privileged. We think, though, that the attorney is on...
That sounds like you are trying to make a difference between CC and 2.
I think there is a difference. If the attorney is on the CC line as opposed to the 2 line, and there's a number of documents that have been produced to us in redacted form, direct communications with attorneys that we haven't challenged. But I think when it's on the CC line, there's at least a question, and particularly when it's among a large group of otherwise non-attorneys.
I don't see why there is any particular difference between a name on the CC line and the name on the 2 line.
Well,
it's the intent of the sender, if they have an intent beyond reply all, to send this document to all the people who are listed on either one of the lines, and I'm not finding in the government submissions why it should matter which line they put it on.
Well, I don't... You're correct, and we're in agreement that it's the intent of the sender that matters.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one...
And the intent's plain if they have the name of the person on there. I don't know why it matters whether it's on CC line.
What?
You may make a difference in that when you're sending email, but I know, we're not supposed to draw on personal experience, I don't guess, but I know I don't.
Well, I think that's the point. Some do, some don't. So when there is, when you are in a CC, and some... If you've worked in a big building, you know not everyone knows how to use reply all properly. So there may be no intent to include an attorney, just someone hit reply all. But I think it's more reasonable to assume it's a step along the way to the conclusion.
So you are trying to make a difference between CC and 2.
Yes, but we're not disputing the mere fact
that answered my question.
The mere fact that they're on the CC line doesn't mean it's not privileged. But I think it does matter with respect a bit to the burden of proof. The final category, I believe, of privilege claims that we have at issue here are communications between non-employees, and I think this also spills over into the CC pile, but communications regarding business matters about which counsel has been consulted. And I think it's useful to think about this a bit as a continuum. I think on the one end, the clearly privileged end, we have communications from an attorney giving legal advice, but there's also some consideration of business issues, so long as the prominent tenor of the attorney communications, the legal advice, those would be privileged. On the other end of the spectrum, the non-privileged point, we have the ultimate business decision that the client makes, regardless of whether it consulted with counsel about that matter. That's an exercise of business judgment. That's, in essence, a public communication. We don't think that is privileged. In the middle, we have non-attorneys contemplating different courses of action in light of legal advice, business considerations that may arise out of, that may relate to the issue. We don't think that those communications are privileged to the extent they don't, those communications on their face don't reveal the advice of counsel. Simply because a matter, a particular problem has been discussed with counsel, all the various business ramifications from that issue should not be cloaked in privilege. It's only the advice from the lawyer to the client that is worthy of protection, and a business person's personal views or its business judgment as to how that advice plays out in the real world shouldn't be privileged.
Okay, I'm going to ask you about one stray thing you said, a person's reaction to getting legal advice. I couldn't tell whether you're saying that a non-lawyer's reaction to the legal advice that the lawyer gave, privileged, always privileged, never privileged, sometimes in between.
Well, I think if it's the reaction back to the attorney, I could see that as being, it's communication with an attorney relating to legal advice. Yes, I could see that being privileged. But if it's a communication to a colleague who's not an attorney, I don't think that would be privileged.
What if it discloses in some way the nature of the advice?
Correct. I think in that circumstance, yes, there's a much stronger argument for it to be privileged. Now, certainly the reaction may be useless from an evidentiary point of view, because the question, if you have an email saying that's ridiculous, and what did you think was ridiculous? Well, the advice of counsel is not going to get you anywhere, but I don't think it's privileged, and that's our point here.
There is one like that that's been disclosed to you already, I take it.
Correct, and I don't have the number offhand, but yes.
Let me take you back to the beginning of your argument just a moment. As you know, we asked the standard of review be set forth in the briefs. You standard of review, it says in table of contents on page 13, it's not. What do you say the standard of review is in this case? So we've got to talk about deference, but what do you say is the standard of review?
I think it's an abuse of discretion, I think that is the typical standard review for these cases, but in circumstances where, like we have here, there are no individualized findings, contradicted by the record, and no legal reasoning, then no deference is due to the opinion. Unless there's anything
further. I'm not understanding the relationship between those two. If you think abuse of discretion is the standard, but if you think no deference is due, that sounds like abuse of discretion is not the standard.
Yeah, well, I'm just as confused as
when reviewing the record, the magistrate judge's opinion is will be reviewed for abuse of discretion. One of the things to look at there is whether it is supported by the record, and I think, or whether it's based on.
That sounds like two different things, though. If the standard is abuse of discretion, or if the standard is we defer, it can't be that we review it and then decide whether we're applying that standard or not. And that when you say you review it and find out it's not supported by the record, then you don't apply that standard. So I can see why you didn't set out the standard of review in your brief, because I don't think you are telling us what it is.
Well, I believe we tried to follow what this court said in the 1997 sealed case, and that the standard is abuse of discretion. A district court abuses its discretion,
right, okay,
when it makes a decision that is based upon a misapprehension of law or is unsupported by the record. Here, I think we have a decision that's unsupported by the record for the reasons
So in that case, it says ordinarily we review for abuse of discretion, but where there's no explanation or findings, then we don't.
Correct.
We don't defer. So we're somewhere in between.
Well, I believe, as I understand it, it's sort of a two-step process. Has there been a misapprehension of law or a clear conflict with the record? If so, then the court will still have to review the record to determine whether or not the magistrate judge's opinion is otherwise supported, and in doing so.
I'm beginning your brief a page later than where your contents say it will be to the statement, a district judge's ruling on the subpoena for production of documentary is ordinarily reviewed for arbitrariness or abuse of discretion. And then you go to the statement about no deference is given if it rests on a misapprehension. I'm still not quite sorting that out, but
I don't want to repeat myself because obviously I'm not being as helpful as I would like to be, but I believe it, as I understand it, it's a two-step process. If one of those prongs are met and it appears that there's an abuse of discretion, then in reviewing the record to see whether it's otherwise supported, the ordinary deference that would be accorded to a trier of fact isn't afforded.
Okay, we'll hear from J.P. Morgan.
Thank you, Chief Judge Garland, and may it please the court. This is an abuse of discretion case under an abuse of discretion standard in which the district court received briefing, heard oral argument, reviewed the disputed materials in camera, and wrote a thoughtful, if brief, opinion. Most of the issues that you heard disputed today, in one way or another, deal with the question whether the communications were made for the right purpose under the law. If you look at the court's order at JA 402, she expressly set forth the governing standard with respect to the required intent that the court must find in these types of cases and expressed every aspect of the law of the circuit. She then proceeded to find, after an in-camera review, that standard was met in this case. Under the law of every appellate court, when a court does that, the findings of fact and mixed questions of fact and law that are implicit in between the standard and the conclusion are presumed to have been made as if set forth in haec verba.
Can I ask you two questions about that? One is the one that FERC counsel raised, which is there's really only one sentence about what the court specifically found. That sentence says, more specifically, the court finds that the redactions are of communications between respondent and its counsel, acting as counsel, with respect to legal advice relating to facts communicated. And as they point out, some of them are not between respondent and counsel. Some are just between non-attorneys.
Like every well-advised litigant on appeal, it always pays to try to turn a Talmudic eye onto the order that you're trying to take an appeal from.
When the order is really has only one sentence on the topic, you don't need much of a microscope.
Well,
there's
no.
Only just one document, one sentence to look at.
Again, Judge Garland, not entirely fair to the district judge who took a fair amount of time with this case. Everybody knew, including the commission and J.P. Morgan and the district judge, that part of the commission's complaint in this case was that some of these emails were not with counsel, and therefore the natural English reading, which I think is an alternative reading that we offered in our brief, and it's a perfectly literate reading, is that what she was getting at was
the non-textualist reading. You mean?
No, it is a textual. It is a textual reading that better accords with the record in this case, which is that the core of the dispute was the extent to which invasion of these communications would disclose the communications between counsel and its clients.
Let me just follow up. So then, imagine there are. We understand the argument about abuse of discretion. We look at some of them, and we just can't tell how the district court could have reached this conclusion. Not that it couldn't. Maybe there is a ground. So maybe somewhere there is an abuse of discretion, somewhere where there isn't, and somewhere we're looking at it and we think to ourselves, well, if the district court had given us a reason or had made a finding, maybe we could have upheld it, but we can't figure it out. What's the appropriate response to those?
Well, I think that the appropriate response starts with the first sentence in your hypothetical, which is, if you can think of a reason why she would have, and she did everything that she was required to do with respect to stating the law and looking at the record, then you assume that in the ordinary course and the presumption of regularity that attaches to your business, that she did what seems, you know, the thing that one would have done in the circumstances. If your question is truly one of uncertainty, which is I cannot imagine how anybody would come to this conclusion with respect to a specific communication, then the usual appellate answer to that is tell me more. Send it back for some additional explanation. I do not believe that that's the situation here, and I think that part of part of the disagreement that we have with the commission really stems from three related propositions in the case law. You know, the first one is, what is the unit of analysis for purpose of identifying what the protected communication is? We argued explicitly in our papers in the district court and here that the unit of analysis is the protected conversation between counsel and the client. The second question that feeds off that is, how do we apply that common law analysis in the world of the 21st century, in which a lot of what used to happen in counsel's office now happens over the email system? And how do we ascertain whether a series of related subject matter emails are part of the same communication that is protected by the attorney-client privilege? In looking at that question, it is not our submission that emails get taken in chains, lock, stock, and barrel as a matter of law, but it is our submission that in the circumstances where you have had a review of the district court, it is entirely within her discretion to identify the bounds of the protected attorney-client conversation with a view to the fundamental purpose of the attorney-client privilege, which is get as far as you can to protect the relationship and not allow the opponent to invade the confidentiality. Some of that may well be over-inclusive or under-inclusive at the margins. I wager that if you have looked at each and every one of these communications carefully, you cannot imagine that we are shielding anything that is arguable because it's a smoking gun. And so, you know, the question here is, what deference does Judge Robinson get in saying this is the core of what needs to be protected to safeguard the attorney-client privilege? The third issue comes straight from Upjohn. I was frankly astonished to hear a federal agency of the United States to take the position that consulting with counsel so that you can conform your affairs and your conduct to the requirements of law is actually business and not law. That is fundamentally inconsistent with social policy and is flatly contrary to the law. And we know that because the social desirability of encouraging clients, personal and corporate, was one of the principal planks that underlay the Supreme Court opinion in Upjohn. And the relevant passage is at pages 392 to 393, where the late Justice Rehnquist, then Justice Rehnquist, points out that in the complex regulated environment in which we all live, it is to be encouraged for corporate clients to seek the advice of counsel in order to conform the corporate conduct to the requirements of law. Once you understand that that is a central insight of Upjohn, then that third question really comes into focus, which is how do you translate the paradigm of the individual client in the common law system meeting in the office of the lawyer to the corporate client who has designated some group of individuals to consult with counsel. One of the questions that you asked, Judge Garland, earlier on seemed to me to get to the core of the problem here, which is no court would entertain calling a client who has met with counsel in a protected session to the stand to ask questions not directly about what was said, but about the reactions of the client, what the client did as a result of the advice, or any of a similar line of questions that purports to be getting at the discovery inferentially of the substance of the advice. One of the good opinions on this subject was written by then District Judge John Newman, now of the Second Circuit, in the SEM versus Xerox case, which is cited in our papers. And in keeping with the Upjohn view that you have to translate the paradigm of the individual client here, you know, the question is not merely whether, you know, the designated people who are tasked with the handling of the legal affair and talking with counsel, talk with counsel and pose a specific legal question, but whether their communications with respect to what then there is to do can be invaded in the fashion that is analogous to putting the individual client on the stand and trying to probe his fears, reactions, and motivations and his prospective conduct in response to the advice. Again, there is not a cookie-cutter answer to that question either. But again, it is one of the reasons why we rely in our system on district courts and the abuse of discretion standard. I would have thought that one of the byproducts of, like, looking at cases like this would be to say, thank God for magistrate judges. But what the...
Well, you might say that only if they come out your way.
No. I was...
Because this argument would require us to defer to them if they decide that it's not privileged also.
No, actually, I think I misspoke, Judge Garland. I was trying to look at this question from
your point of view. Got it.
But since you've
already given us all these documents anyway, we've already passed the point of view of saving us work.
Right, but I'm sure that in doing that, you kept firmly in mind the relative institutional competences of both courts. And the fact is that the magistrate judges in our circuit, as in others, do a lot of this bulk.
It doesn't matter if it's a magistrate judge or the district judge.
It does not matter. This is a judgment of the district court that is here under review. But, you know, this is a discovery process in which by now nearly a million documents have been produced. Mm-hmm. What is involved here is a handful, literally a handful of email chains that the government has subdivided.
Did it ever cross the minds of counsel to use the same designation for these documents between the appellant and the appellee?
Well,
you have any idea how much easier that would have made the court's job?
I understand that.
Especially the numbering of the emails.
I understand, and I, you know, with all apologies to the court, I tried to explain that in our brief because we filed the relevant evidentiary materials in the district court that were tab A, B, and C. Those things are in chronological order by and large. You know, the commission, for reasons of its own, chose to disaggregate them and put them in a different order. But I think
neither of you chose to put out a list here that cross-referenced
either. Oh, no, that is not right. You know, the commission has a chart at the end of their brief that actually deals with that, Judge Santel. But again, I think, you know, the commission here is a little bit crazy like a fox, right? Because, you know, the whole point of taking what is an ordinary understanding and a more or less integrated and cohesive conversation and breaking it up in parts is to try to take it away from the common law model that ought to inform what is the bound of the communication that is actually protected. Now, if I could say...
Before you say,
yeah,
I'll give you some chance. I want to ask, I finally found the email I was talking with opposing counsel about, the That's Ridiculous email, mm-hmm. which is at SA 34 of yours. Now that, I appreciate you haven't waived anything by disclosing it, but if we could focus on that one as a hypothetical, which since it's in the clear, I can at least ask you about. So, it's SA 34. It's from Blythe Masters to Francis Dunleavy, March 14th.
I have, this is the sealed appendix?
Yeah, your sealed appendix, page
34.
The second to the last email. It's not one of the numbered ones because it's not one
minute time.
Yeah, 12:36:10.
I am, since it's no one of the ones that's at issue, I'm sort of having a problem.
So do you have essay? Do you have this sealed appendix?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
On the bottom of, on essay 34, it's the second from the bottom.
Yeah.
Original message.
That's ridiculous?
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
So is there an argument? I appreciate that you haven't waived, but so therefore you could make an argument about this if you were going to. Do you think this one is privileged or not privileged?
Well, look, Judge Garland, we start with the proposition that the communication as a whole, which is to say the entire subject matter conversation, is privileged. Part of the fight that led to the meet and confer and to led to the disclosure of these things only upon an agreement of non-waiver comes from our view that the legally appropriate unit of inquiry is the protected communication. So my view is it was privileged. It is no longer privileged.
But is it privileged only so I guess I have two questions, and I'm only using this as a hypothetical because given everything's sealed, it's a little hard to talk about these things, but this one's not hard to talk about. This one, which you might describe as a response to something, right, whatever the something is, that's ridiculous, doesn't disclose by itself. We'll ask about the context in a minute, but it doesn't by itself describe what it is that's ridiculous. Therefore, if what Masters is saying is ridiculous is some kind of legal advice, it certainly doesn't describe that. And it also doesn't tell us whether the thing that Masters thinks was ridiculous was legal or not legal. So by itself, you don't have an argument that if we weren't looking at this entire context, by itself, it wouldn't be privileged. Is that right? Do you agree?
And in fact, I will go further than that, Judge Garland, and I will say that if I meet with an individual client in my office and it is established beyond doubt that he has come to tell me about the legal problems of his life, of which he has many and weighty, and in a three-hour meeting there are any number of social pleasantries, and I offer him tea, and I ask him about his travel schedule back home, all of those things, if held up to the light independently, would not be privileged. But the harm of the analysis is that once you start invading what happened in the conversation, it is the elephant's nose under the tent to try to get at, you know, one by one. And so, I'm sorry, Justin, tell, I didn't hear.
I think it's usually the camel rather than the elephant.
Yes. Well, I'm not from here.
And neither are camels.
But the fact is,
So, but the argument about the elephant's nose fits the other way, right? You could, if we thought that everything on an email chain is protected, then you could add anything you want to the email chain. So how do we
notice?
Where do we slice the chain?
Notice, Chief Judge Garland, that when I said that the relevant legal question that underlies some of this is what is the unit of analysis as to what comprises the communication, I immediately said it is not my position that anything that is attached to a string email.
Right. So how?
What it is my position is that it is a question of fact on which there is some amount of discretion to identify the boundaries, and that that is the role of the district judge, not one that this court does de novo. And what I would further
so if the district judge had gone the other way on this one. That'd be tough luck for you.
Well, I think I would say that she was intellectually wrong at some level, but based on the context of the email, I could not possibly get her overturned. And given what the email says, no harm, no foul. One of the things that I think you have to keep firmly in mind as well, Judge Garland, is what Judge Silberman tenderly gave us as the law of the circuit, the crown jewels doctrine. Even though the question of subject matter waiver is no longer relevant to this case, because in the meet and confer, we actually had a deal on that question. The issue here is what is counsel who is preparing to assert the privilege to do in good faith to prevent really assertive federal agencies to then claim subject matter waiver. And from the point of view of the counsel who's making the privilege call, and from the district court who's looking at whether this is indeed a valid claim of privilege, you really have to consider whether any effort to accommodate the opposition by giving parts of the conversation.
I want to be clear,
I
understand that point. And I'm not suggesting that by showing us this particular piece, you waived anything or anything like that. I'm only trying to figure out, using this as an example, what you would suggest as the guide for how many other things on that same chain are privileged and are not. And how the district court can make that decision.
If I could
I mean, if your only answer is we have to do whatever the district court tells us, then
I can actually give you an example that I hope will be perfectly understandably publicly, even though it does involve, you know, the material under seal. If you look at all of the emails in Exhibit D, which is like 3-4. D as in dog. I'm told that's another animal. I have two of them. And if you look at that, there is, at the root of the conversation, at SA-37, a core email that underlies a lot of these exchanges, which for the life of me, I cannot imagine how any federal agency could possibly dispute privilege on. It says, you know, the intention of the sender is first evidenced by privilege and confidential. I am sending this. And then it says, I spoke to outside counsel. Here's what she said. Now, I have no confidence that, I mean, I have perfect confidence that there is no court in the world that would turn down a claim of privilege on that email. And the question then arises, if that claim is upheld, the commission knows that the root of the discussion for all of these emails is, I spoke to outside counsel, and here's what she said. And based with that knowledge, after you uphold that claim of privilege, I invite you to just randomly, just for the heck of it, then read, you know, item 7, item 8, item 6, and read it together with it. And you tell me if you cannot infer the subject matter of the communications with counsel, even if item 4 is never disclosed. And so this is why when the magistrate judge is trying to look at these questions, she has a fair amount of discretion to identify the protected communications with a view to what she is able to do better with a mastery of the record to understand, based on the declarations and the hearing, how it is that it all fits together and the relative likelihood of a danger of the disclosure of confidential information.
That is very helpful. Mm-hmm. So again, looking at that as the root of this discussion that we're talking about, again, looking at the that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So assume for purposes of the hypothetical that the that's ridiculous is Dunleavy's response to the email you spoke about, and assume for purposes of the discussion that, in fact, what that last email, the root email, is the legal advice. So if one non-lawyer says to another lawyer, having heard the legal advice, your legal advice, and says, that's ridiculous, and that's all, nothing else. That is, it's a response to legal advice in the sense of, that's ridiculous. Is that privileged?
I think the answer is depends. And the reason it depends has as its first important component the SCM versus Xerox issue that I raised earlier, whether if this were a single individual with a single brain who can communicate internally with himself, whether he could be probed on the stand on his reaction, whether he thought this was good advice, bad advice, or silly advice. And if that's not something that could be done with the individual, then the question is when the record supports that the people having the conversation are solely those that have been tasked by the corporation under Upjohn to interact with counsel and to frame the corporation's legal response to the legal issue, then the type of vetting of the advice so that they can crystallize whether additional advice is needed or whether other questions should be posed, it is almost analogous to trying to probe, you know, the individual. Whether that would be true in that case, I don't say. But what I do say is that the district court in this case had an ample evidentiary record for concluding that it is true here.
Would it be okay? I see. So if you gave advice to an individual, and the individual said back to you, that's ridiculous, that would be privileged, that would be a communication?
Yes.
Yes. If instead that person said it to somebody who was completely outside, it would not be. My lawyer just gave me stupid advice.
That would be waiver.
Correct. So in this case, it's the fact that there are two people within the Upjohn group.
For purposes of how we accommodate the corporate entity to the paradigm of the individual, the types of things that, you know, McCormick deals with in Section 87 of his treatise. The question is whether this is really trying to probe, you know, the brain of the client in trying to impede the ability of the corporation to effectively avail itself of the advice of counsel as an individual would. If I could say just one word on the question of personal knowledge, actually three short words. I guess I should think it obvious that under that, that the personal knowledge requirement that is set forth in Federal Rule of Evidence 602 does not apply to questions of privilege as determined by the district court, because that's what Rule 104A says. You know, there is an ambiguity in Rule 104A as to whether, you know, questions of privilege apply, but that ambiguity was solved by the Supreme Court in Zolin when it said that it is a matter of course that you, of course, consider at the instance of the proponent of the privilege conversations as part of the evidence without having a waiver. And so that the fact that there is not a circularity in the rule was the issue in Zolin.
Well, can I bring this down to a more specific question, which I'm not sure I'm following? So when you said personal knowledge, I took that to be a discussion of whether the affidavit, which we have, which is by outside counsel, could know what, say, Ms. Dunleavy was thinking. So where the counsel who provided, that's Krupke, I think, right? where the advice that Krupke, where her affidavit talks about the intent of the various speakers in these emails, and she is not the speaker.
Well, I think
what do we do with that?
It is clear from her affidavit, Judge Garland, that in addition to being a participant to one of these, to many of these exchanges, including many that are not actually being challenged here, she was in routine contact with practically all of the speakers on the subject matter of the investigation, that a lot of what is being sort of said and sort of asked for is stuff that she asked for in telephonic conversations, and that she has ample personal knowledge if that were required. The purpose of my starting with Rule 104A is to point out that it is not required, but it is in fact amply met here. The second point about your question is that their argument is less a personal knowledge argument than a best evidence claim. In practically every area of the law, intent is proven by circumstantial evidence. I suppose under their theory, a plaintiff in a racial discrimination case could never win unless the defendant had the gentility to testify in his favor. And yet,
assume we've never had similar arguments in Title VII cases.
Well,
come awfully close at times.
But in any event, that is in keeping with how the law usually proves intent, and in this case, she was a percipient witness for everything that was needed to decide the question of privilege. The third point is that, you know, the rule that the agency is urging is not a rule that even the agency wants to live with, because although it may not be apparent to the agency at this moment, they are a litigant as an agency in FOIA cases under Exception 5 that routinely asserts the question of attorney-client privilege. In those cases, it is almost uniformly the practice of the government for them to submit attorney affidavits, most of whom have no personal knowledge of the origin of the communications at issue. In fact, just for the sport of it, I had a colleague, a second-year associate yesterday, pull a FERC case involving FOIA, and sure enough, I got an affidavit with a conclusory assertion of the attorney-client privilege by one of, you know, my opponent's colleagues that was filed in this district. If you're interested, you know, the case is called Reliant Energy, and the relevant paragraph of the affirmation is paragraph 33. I don't think, unless the court has any other questions, I have anything further today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Is there rebuttal time? I'm afraid we probably ate it up, so I'll give you a couple more minutes.
Picking up on counsel's last point, and I appreciate his review of our FOIA practice. But I think to analyze and make an analogy, to the civil process, you assert a privilege by producing a privilege log. That's very general. Ultimately, that may percolate into a dispute. The privilege log is prepared by outside counsel, no personal knowledge. But if that reaches court and push comes to shove, and you're asserting a privilege that turns on the intent of the authors, then yes, you may need to come up with more than a declaration from outside counsel.
Well,
to make clear,
Mr. Estrada points to a rule that he didn't cite in his brief, and therefore probably surprised you. But Rule 104A does say that the court must decide any preliminary questions about whether a privilege exists. And so deciding, the court is not bound by evidence rules.
And our point is not that Ms. Krupka's declaration is inadmissible. Our point, and I have not seen this, and I have to assume it a little bit because I can't see the declaration, but they've never said that she talked with these people. She determined, they told her that the reason she sent these, the reason counsel was copied was to secure legal advice. As best I can tell, it's not addressed in there. So again, it's not admissibility, it's just a failure of proof.
You wouldn't be against her reporting by hearsay what others intended. What you're saying is she may not have any idea at all what others intended.
Well, again, I haven't.
I'm just asking.
You're correct. I haven't studied Rule 104.
If she said, Mr. Dunleavy told me this, then that would be acceptable. If she didn't say anything about that other than if Dunleavy intended this, but there's no indication that she actually has any idea about that, then you would dispute it. Is that
correct?
Fair place to draw the
correct
line.
Correct. Also, in terms of the unit of inquiry, what's a communication? Counsel talked about a meeting in his office with a client. Another setting, to bring it back to the individual client, could be a meeting where among business people where counsel is present. And the cases are legion that just because counsel is in the room doesn't mean everything said in that meeting is privileged. You have to look at it on a communication by communication basis. And I heard him make the point that, well, if you do that, you may not figure out the advice that was given, but the subject, the topic you could discover, and that's not privileged. It may be slicing it thin, but that's not privilege. You have to disclose as much on a privilege log. Finally, I would counsel cited the Xerox case, and I would invite the court to look at that in terms of how you have to disaggregate these. This is an exercise in line drawing. I appreciate that. But Xerox makes the point that when a legal topic is discussed, the business implications of that, what business considerations went into the ultimate decision, are not privileged. You have to, the best you can, tease these issues apart.
Assume the affidavit is not admissible, is not a word we wanted to use, but it's not needs to be personal perception on the question of intent. Suppose that affidavit's thrown out altogether. Can we not still take the content of the emails and determine the same question?
Well, I think
I'm trying to decide how important that affidavit is in the first.
Well, I think it's very important in the context of this case. Yes, the court can look at the content of the documents, and intent may be apparent from the face of this document.
It can't be the case that there has to be an affidavit from somebody involved in the communication. The privilege survives the death of the participants.
I'm sorry?
Privilege survives the death of the
participants.
So,
right.
It can't be the case. I mean, this court once incorrectly held that it didn't, and the Supreme Court quite correctly reminded us that it did.
Right. Right. No, but I think when you're on the margins, when there is, and certainly these people are here, the authors, there's been no claim that would be too burdensome or they're gone. But when your claim is on the margins and it's not apparent from the face of the document, then I think it's, as the proponent of the privilege, it's your burden to do what you can to establish to a reasonable degree of certainty the privilege factors.
Can we not take anything from the context that this is all arises sort of after the point at which what looks like litigation is going to begin? That is, there's already an inquiry. This is not business as usual anymore. This is now a time when FERC has started to make inquiries and the communications with the lawyers, as you can tell from the subject lines, which are not redacted, at least as to many of them, are in response to an inquiry, which everybody would expect will at some point involve either where we are now or some level of legal review.
Correct.
Is that not a more, I mean, your, many of your arguments are about business advice in the normal course of giving business advice, where nobody has any particular reason to think that there's going to be a law problem, and if somebody is CC'd on it who's a lawyer, well, maybe it just doesn't make any difference. Maybe they're just asking lawyers for their business advice. But we're now, all the emails you're asking come after that cutoff.
Correct. And I think certainly I would expect there to be privileged conversations that would arise out of that context. And there's a number of emails to attorneys that as I understand it, we haven't made any challenges to their privilege claims. The context is relevant, yes, but I think it only gets you so far, and you only have to look at exhibits, I think, 3 and 4 of the commission's petition, which are the 28 emails originally withheld and subsequently produced that are from the same time period, share a lot of the same headers, and there's stuff in there that's absolutely not.
FERC's investigation of the business activities extend after this time period? Or is this an investigation of activities that occurred before the time period?
No, I believe that it does extend past it includes this time period that we're looking at here, the 2011 time period.
After the date?
Correct. I mean, I think these emails go from March to November 2011. And yes, it does extend into that period.
Further questions? All right, we'll take the matter under submission. Thank you.
Thank you.